Good afternoon. So last time we did some Q&A on the assignment. I'll have more to say about that, especially now that I look through a sample of the submissions that didn't pass the auto grader. And we also did an example of the multi-level page table lookup, sort of with sort of toy sizes for everything. Then we started talking about networking. So we mentioned that kind of the thing that the internet gives us are these unreliable networks. This something that's sometimes called a best effort model, where we have limited message size, and sometimes messages are lost. Sometimes they're delayed, they're reordered, sometimes they're corrupted, and we have things built on top of that that handle that. And we mentioned kind of a bunch of strategies for this. So one was that, well, if messages are limited in size, we'll have sequence numbers. We'll divide it up into pieces, we'll number each piece. If messages don't always get there, we'll have acknowledgments. And when we don't get some sort of verification that the thing we want came back, we'll have to resend after a timeout. So someone is going to have to be responsible for saying, this didn't get there, let me send it again. Or request that it be sent again. And we mentioned that acknowledgments are messages, so they can get lost. And because we have this policy of keeping trying, that's okay. Though we have some corner cases where, we might not know if a message really got there. And that's just kind of inevitable. There's no real way to avoid that because, eventually we have to give up in practice, right? We can't just keep asking, did you get it, did you get it, did you get it? We have to give up, and sometimes when we give it up, they haven't gotten it. And sometimes when we give up, they did, and they just didn't have a way to tell us. And we also mentioned that messages get corrupted. So we talked about a solution for that, which was checksums. So basically, we take the hash of a message of some sort of hash function. Typically, the name used is checksum, and we include that with the message, and we check that when we get it. And if it doesn't match, when we recompute it, we say, well, something changed in the message. It's bad. Let's reject it or at least do something about it. And, the most common solution is we just pretend it wasn't delivered. Okay, we're just lost instead. Because we already have to handle messages being lost. Why write extra code to handle them being corrupted? So questions about things we covered last time. How does a program know what's the start of a message and the end of a message? So last time we introduced this idea of these layers, right? And basically we have some layer which is responsible for knowing how to use the wires or the radio. And above that we have some layer called the link layer, which is responsible for coordinating multiple people sharing a wire or sharing a radio. And that layer is going to have some way of delimiting messages that we're going to take advantage of ultimately as we go up all the other layers. Does that answer your question? And I guess I would say, as far as what that mechanism is, it's going to depend on what we're implementing it on. So because different sort of physical types of cabling or types of radio might have different ways of doing that. Other questions? Yes? Can I go over the last question on the quiz? Is that question 5? Yes, okay. So, this question is asking about allocate on demand. And our kind of assumption was that when we started the program, the page table wasn't filled in at all. And we need to think about, what's going to happen when this program runs? So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to try to run the function. And remember, nothing's loaded yet, so this is going to cause a page fault. Because when we jump to the code, presumably at address 2040, but we didn't actually say, then we're going to try to read from that address because that's part of running a function, trying to load from that address. And the processor is going to say, gosh, can't do that. It's going to ask the OS for help. It's going to say, hey, OS, this program tried to run code at address 2040. What do I do about that? And to fix that, the OS is going to run its page fault handler, and it's going to have to load that code. And we set in the question that it loads as little as possible, but all we can tell the processor about is a whole page. So our page table entry, when we set it, it's going to make the whole page valid, and the page that contains address 2040 goes from 2000 to 2FFF, based on the sizes in the question. So that means that when we load just 2040, we're actually loading 2000 to 2FFF, and that means that we're never going to have any more page faults for reading the code of the function anymore, because we've just loaded the whole thing. That was the least we could do, the way the processor, you know, knows about what's loaded. Then this code writes to a bunch of addresses here, and the first time we try to do a write, it's going to not work, because the processor is going to say, hey, I don't know where that address is supposed to be in physical memory. And it's going to ask the OS for help. The OS is going to load the page containing that address, you know, which is going to be that whole page, so that this whole range of addresses, and that loading is going to set up for the other writes to also work without any page faults. So we end up with two page faults, one for each of the two things we actually need to load, and we can't load in any smaller units, so we end up loading like a bunch of things at once because, well, we have to set a page table entry. We can't like set a byte table entry to specify each byte. We have to specify the whole page. So questions on a question? Yes.
So does it not matter like how many levels you have to allocate? It'll only page fault one time?
So question, does it not matter how many levels you have to allocate? It will only page fault one time? Yes. So what's going to happen is the program's going to try to access something that's not going to work, and the OS is going to be told, this is the address it was trying to access. So yes, hypothetically, you could write an OS which only fails in the first level in a multi-level table, but if you do that, you can be sure that when you return from your page fault handler, you're going to get another page fault with nothing happening, no progress being made. So that wouldn't make sense to do. And you have the information because what the processor is going to tell you is, I was trying to look this up, and it didn't work. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay. And I worded this wrong. So some themes from anonymous feedback. I'm going to talk about each of these in turn. So first, with the page table assignment. Some people thinking we haven't learned about some things in the assignment. Some people thinking we need to rely on TA's word of mouth for things like how to use memset or POSIX metaline, which I'll explain what I think was going on there. And some saying that our lectures were maybe not close enough to the homeworks. So. Obviously, like, I think, I'll talk about, like, what I think went wrong with the homework. So I think the biggest problem and what my biggest, the reason why my expectations for what would happen versus what actually happened are so different is I overestimated your familiarity with C from CS01. So for example, POSIX memaline uses pointers in a way which a lot of people are finding confusing. I had assumed that this was something that was covered well in CS01 and that people remembered from CS01. And I know it's covered in CS01 because I've like seen the final and there's like a question about using pointers in a similar way on it. But apparently like actual grasp of that is not where I expected it to be. But because of that, I kind of my assumption reading the assignment was, oh, you learned about man pages in CS01, you learned about pointers in CS01 a bunch. That shouldn't be something I need to talk about, but wasn't true. Probably in future semesters, that doesn't help this semester, the warm-up assignment should change to use pointers because people need practice, definitely. And also, I've seen, especially looking at submissions, there are a lot of pointer issues that are causing people problems, and that seems to be like maybe as much or more of a problem than understanding page table issues. And often maybe a lot more of a problem. Another thing is that there's some things in the write-up which needed to be more explicit. They're in there, but they're not as explicit as they should be. So one was the page table entry format. It's been there the whole time, but a lot of people didn't really read it, and that made them confused when the testing code said, or tester that you submitted to said, it doesn't, the all bits aren't set right. Because if you didn't use that format, you're confused. Also, what needed to be allocated was kind of implied because Translate had to give you something you could access. So we didn't state as explicitly as you could have, oh, you're allocating where the data goes. But that's because Translate returns someplace we can store data. But wasn't stated explicitly, probably should have. The other issue is testing. My impression from having gone through sort of 40 random submissions that didn't pass all the autograder tests is that a lot of people are writing a lot of code before they test anything. And maybe you're under, this is an assignment where that does not work. And our autograder tests are not meant to substitute for you testing things as you write them, and nor is the sort of example code in the assignment. And I think a lot of people, are hoping, I can just write this whole thing and then debug it later, and my experience trying to do things like that is I'm going to spend 20 times more time debugging things than if I wrote it in little pieces, and tried to figure out a way of checking that each little piece was okay before I really moved on. And also from submissions, I have a lot of submissions where, it really looks like there was no way you could have tested it before you got, anywhere based on how the code looks. To me, maybe I'm not seeing everything, obviously, because I've only seen the file submitted, but that's sort of the impression I got reading over a bunch of code. And that's a strategy which is going to probably make you spend a lot more time in the long run than pausing for a few minutes and saying, this is the first part of the function, doesn't do what I think it does. So questions on those sorts of difficulty issues? Yes?
Just out of curiosity, what percent of people from the page table one got all of the stuff that you were looking for?
What percent had everything that I was looking for?
Yeah.
Maybe 25, 20? Sometimes it was the minor problems. I only mentioned the biggest problems. There, the other two classes of problems, besides pointer issues and sort of things that seem related to testing, are some people submitted make files that don't work, and usually don't work because they make it a library, but the library doesn't include the code. there's some cases like that, and some people have bitwise manipulation issues was another common issue. Yeah. Question, how do you test to make sure the library contains what you want? If you make a program that links against it and calls one of the functions, that will test that. So some people just didn't do that, which I understand. You didn't think to do that, but our grader did. And we noticed, yeah.
So just for clarification, you want us in the page table, you want us to store the physical memory address where all the tokens bits are zero except the last bit is one, the validator?
So the question is, what's stored in the page table? Okay, so we can skip ahead. So page table entries have this format specified in the assignment where we have a physical page number, some unused bits, and a valid bit. And note that the physical page number is not the physical address, it is part of the physical address. The physical address being the thing you'll get from POSIX memo line, the pointer you'll get there. So, as you can see, I prepared this. Yes, I was planning on talking about these issues in a bit. First, yes, a logistical thing. So what I'm doing for grading for page table assignment to let you know, and I'll let you know about the second submission. So for the first submission, have some grading breakdown. For the second one, everything being present, there's a README that is a README, a makefile that is a makefile, is going to be 50% of that grade, 40% for levels equals one working, 10% for levels greater than one working. And the first two parts are 25% of a normal homework each. The last part is 200%. That's where we're going to do most of our grading. The first two parts are just to make sure you aren't doing the whole thing in the last week. Also, we're going to do a code review for lab next week. This means that if you aren't in lab in person, you probably won't get credit. If you can't be in lab in person, you should talk to me, and we'll figure something out. And I want you to have something that's good for you to show other students during that lab, which is part of why there's a grade for submission too. And you'll be able to use anything you learn from other students reviewing your code to fix up for submission three. Can I go over some of the common bitwise operations and masking we would need for page tables? I think enough people understand that from CSO1 that I shouldn't spend class time reviewing that. I'd be happy to talk about it elsewhere, but probably not during class. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so let's review some pointer stuff that has come up on the assignment. So let's say I have a size T, so an 8-byte value on our systems. It happens to be stored at address 30, but it contains the value 50. And I want to access what's in the memory address it stores. So this would be like our PTBR. It's a size T, but it contains a memory address. I can't do this. This is a compile time error because the compiler says, gosh, you can't dereference a size T like that. But I can convert the size T to a pointer to the type I want to find at that address, in this case, another size T. And then I'll get the value at that address, except I offset this whole slide by 16 bytes. Okay. So we'll just cross that off. This is okay, like so. So questions? If I want to access the second thing after that pointer, treating it as an array of size t's, I can't use array indexing because it's not a pointer type or an array type. I could compute the byte address in the array. So in this case, I said, 16 bytes after x would be this value, turn that to a pointer, dereference it. I could convert the original address to a pointer, then treat it like an array. Questions on this, hopefully, pointer review. Yeah?
Can I just do all the math and then do the last slide where I cast it to a pointer?
The question is, could I do the cast, should I like do these two lines in one line? Absolutely. I have not done that because I think that is hard to read. Okay. Other questions? So let's say we have my example here. I have a function here that gets its argument and uses that to change something. So let's say I want to use this function to change a value to OXFFFF. So if I want to use it to change X, I can pass a pointer to X with the address of operator, or if I happen to know where X is located, I can just write down that address and convert it to a pointer. If I try to get like a pointer, do this syntax, which some of you have tried to do with our page table based register, that gets a pointer to the thing after X in memory, which usually wouldn't be what you intended. But it worked. But it compiles. If I want to use what X points to for this function, I can convert X to a pointer because it expects a pointer, it uses the pointer to change the value to that FFFF. And let's say I just take my size T here and replace every size T with a different type. And the type I'm going to choose, for a very particular reason, is a pointer to void. I'm just going to substitute size T with pointer to void, Here we go. So you see here, I call this function with a pointer to x, and it changes x for me. This is what POSIX MemoLine does. That's why it takes a void star star. And this issue has caused a lot of confusion on the assignment. A lot of people, were casting something as the first parameter to POSIX MemoLine, but not keeping in mind that it's going to be used in this kind of way. So questions? Out. Pointer. Okay, so that's on some C issues I saw looking through submissions. Let's talk about sort of issues with the actual sort of mechanics of the page table. So we mentioned the page table format. So the page table entry, we say it has the physical page number after the bottom PO bits. So this is what it looks like, and you may notice that it's not a coincidence that this lines up nicely with how physical addresses are stored. That's meant to be convenient, but you don't have to take advantage of it. And our virtual addresses have a virtual page number, which isn't necessarily the whole size T, and a page offset. And our physical address, page number, page offset. And what translate does is it takes our page table base register, uses that to find our array of page table entries. This is with levels equals 1. We take the virtual page number from VA, and that gets us a page table entry, which is going to have a physical page number and our valid bit. We use that physical page number to compute the beginning of physical page with that number by potentially multiplying by the page size or bit shifting. And then we add in the page offset and translate VA returns that number. It doesn't return the value at that number, it returns that number. Questions? Not. And page allocate does the same kind of lookup, but we're going to find a page table entry that's probably invalid sometimes. And we will fix it to make it have a new page number pointing to space we allocated with POSIX MemoLine. And I'm sorry, I should have made these slides last week. Wasn't thinking about what the misunderstandings were. Questions? Okay, so as I mentioned, next week's lab, code review your submission to with other students. So it's in person. If you can attend lab, talk to me, and you can use the feedback to improve your submission 3. So then, mention the next theme in anonymous feedback was lab difficulty. So a lot of people had trouble with the lab, more than I expected, and it seems like the main point of difficulty was something I kind of thought was a relatively trivial matter, wasn't, and that was sort of the mechanics of how the received function work. And this is probably something in the future I should introduce in lecture, because this is actually, the lab is showing a very common programming pattern that you'll see, especially in networking code and some other contexts. And this is callback-based programming. So there's some library code you don't write which has a loop like this, where it runs this loop forever, and the loop figures out what's the next thing we're going to do. And based on that, it does these things which are going to end up calling your code. So in this case, part of your code was received. So we have some loop that's going to end up calling received. Or if you set a timeout, it has some loop that ends up calling the timeout function you specified. And so in this model, the idea is you only write functions that are called by this big loop and do something quickly and then go back to the big loop. You don't spend lots of time in your function. If you want to do something later, you tell the code that's writing the loop, hey, call me later. And so you just end up writing these little functions. And I think understanding that was probably a larger part of the lab for people than we expected. Yes.
I have a question about like the code review, like before you started talking about like pass lab.
Okay.
What's stopping like, so like let's say like my program works fine and I don't need to be like, reviewed because it's fine. Like what's stopping me from like basically just having the same exact code with other two people that like theirs isn't working? Wouldn't I essentially just be like giving them my code? So would we all three just have the same code by the lab?
Okay, so the question is, after the code review, wouldn't we all three have the same code? So I guess a couple things on this. So one is that I expect your code to be obviously related to the code you submitted for submission two. We also require an acknowledgments file explaining where you got things from. So if you do that, you should be telling me all about it. Thirdly, the code review is meant to be giving specific comments on your code, not how do I do this.
Okay.
Right, it's like, this is organized poorly. Like that's the sort of information you should be giving people in the code review, not I did it this way. It's not fix my bugs, it's make my code be better organized, more readable, etc. Other questions? Okay. And so this callback-based programming, it comes up all over the place. So probably the most prominent example today is that if you're writing scripts in a web page, this is the kind of interface you're going to get from the browser. You're not going to write something that's running all the time, typically. Typically, you're going to write stuff that the browser is going to call at various points. Many graphical user interface libraries work this way, so if you're using those. Servers that handle lots of connections are sometimes written in this style, where rather than having like you did in the sockets assignment, one piece of code that handles one connection at a time you'll get called whenever you need to do something on a connection. And do something and then go back to this big loop that's handling all the connections. Yeah?
What's the difference between callback-based programming and event-driven?
What's the difference between callback-based programming and event-driven? Same thing. Yeah, so I could also have written event-driven programming / event-driven. They're the same thing. So the other thing in the lab that was a little confusing was the protocol. So I think the big thing, which was I probably could have matched better in lecture, warned a little better about, but I don't think it was as much of a problem, is that the message is called ACK. You're requesting the next message by acknowledging the previous one. But in the lab, you were responsible for resending. We made the decision someone has to resend to make sure it gets there. In the lab, we decided it's you, not the other end, even though you're sending a message which contains ACK in it. Okay. And also, and as a last theme for anonymous feedback, I have people saying various things about the quizzes. Some people want the quizzes longer. Some people say the quizzes are too difficult. I suspect they don't want them longer. Like partial credit on the quizzes, I probably should think more about dividing my questions into smaller pieces, which I sometimes don't do. But sometimes I'm writing questions hastily, so it's part of why that doesn't happen. Also question, would I ever consider dropping the lowest quiz grade? Well, congratulations. If you look at the policies page since the beginning of the semester, I'm doing that. Any other logistics questions or networking lab questions? Okay, so last time we talked about these layers. So we're going to look more about these layers today. And we said we have this sort of physical layer where we encode the bits on our medium, which can be like wires or radio, typically those two things. And then we have some protocol on top of that that coordinates how we share that. Because even if we have a wire from one machine to another machine directly, we're still sharing that in some way. We have to know, you know, and even if it's only a one-way wire, we still have to coordinate like, how are things formatted? How do I know when a message starts? And so that's all the link layer protocol. And the most common examples of link layer we deal with are Ethernet. So the most common sort of wired network you've probably used, and Wi-Fi. There are a bunch of others, but you're probably not going to encounter them much. Well, not directly, at least. Some of them you probably have encountered, like cable modems. That's a different like layer protocol. Then above that, we have this network protocol where we reach the connect machines. This is the layer that gives us that best effort delivery that we're used to from the, networking lab and what we our discussion previously. And this handles reaching the correct machine even when we have to go through multiple machines in the middle. And we'll talk about how that works later. And I mentioned we have the Internet Protocol version 4 and version 6. So those both are in use and both handle that same problem. Then we have these transport protocols, and this is where we do the things you were implementing in the lab, like reliability, dealing with corrupted or lost messages, and sort of combining things up into streams when we want to do that. And TCP and UDP are probably by far the most common transport protocols. There are a few others, but nothing you're likely to encounter. And then we have these application protocols, where we have some application-defined meaning built on top of the transport layer. So HTTP, which is how your browser receives sort of website information, files on web servers. This one, SSH, which is how when you SSH to a portal, there's a protocol which defines, I'm sending a command, I'm receiving, where's the output of the command, and so on. SMTP, another example here, is how sending mail works. So we have a way of saying, here's an email message for you. So these are places where, on top of that, we add some defined meanings for what we expect to happen when we make a connection on top, and what's going to be sent where. And I've sort of shown that we have these four layers, and you might be aware that maybe this diagram doesn't have enough layers. So there's two ways that's true. So one way is you might know about something called the OSI model, which has a bunch of other layers called the presentation layer and a few others. I think that model is mostly not useful, but you may learn about it because some people think it's important. But there's a more practical way in which these layers don't work is that often we kind of have like application layers on top of application layers. So for example, HTTPS is HTTP, which is an application layer, but rather than going on top of TCP, it's going on top of TLS, which is a layer for doing, above TCP for doing security stuff, which we'll talk about probably in a week or two. Or there's something called DNS over HTTPS. So DNS is usually an application layer protocol, but we can also run it over HTTP, running over TLS. And this is something that Firefox does by default now. Like real things people do. So there's all sorts of fun ways in which we maybe violate this layer. Yes? Question, do these layers function independently or do they interact? And so I guess for the most part, they're independent in the sense that conceptually, we should be able to take HTTP, and if we had something else that provided the features TCP provided, we could use that with HTTP. So like the layers provide us some sort of set of functionality, and any layer above that can use anything that implements that functionality, even if it's different than the layer that they actually are using in practice. So that's kind of the theory. In practice, like sometimes people are going to make assumptions about what the layer below does and maybe rely on more than just like that it sends messages. So for example, we might rely on having addresses be of machine, having machines' identities be specified the way IPv4 does in our application layer protocols. So we might be tied to that specific network layer in that way. Even though sort of conceptually, we should be able to like substitute it with any other implementation of the same functionality. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? question, can I think of these higher level protocols like the transport and application protocols as kind of Russian nesting dolls or like decorators on top of the other protocols? Yes, yeah, that is probably a reasonable way of thinking about things. Other questions? Okay, so we have these layers, and with these layers, we have something that's going to come up is how we name things. And I want to talk about the concept of names versus addresses. And you've seen this concept because you've seen memory addresses. So like if I have a variable called counter, that's its name. But its address, you know, is going to be something depending on how I compile my program and so on. And we have the same distinction between names and addresses on networks. That for machines, we have names typically done via DNS, which we'll talk about sometime later. And you've probably seen names like this, like www.virginia.edu, that's a DNS name. But that's not useful information for directly locating the machine. Just like counter isn't useful for a processor to actually locate the value of the counter. That the machine, the processor, it wants an address to locate that value. And in the same way, the network wants an address to locate the machine. It doesn't want this name. So we're going to have to do a conversion. We'll talk about how from these names to addresses. And we have addresses for IPv4 and IPv6. So for the network layer, we also often have addresses in the link layer. So this MAC address is an address that my desktop has for its link layer for Ethernet. Also, we have the same kind of distinction between names we give for services and their corresponding port numbers. I'm not sure how much, we'll talk about port numbers later. I think you learned about port numbers in CS01 because you did sockets, at least to know that they're a thing you need to specify. But port numbers basically identify a particular program, and we have sort of standardized port numbers that, you know, we'll say this is the SSH port, but on the network we can't say that. We have to give a number. Yes?
Where are the IP addresses point to?
Where do the IP addresses point to?
Like, in the case of like a memory address, it points to somewhere in like physical memory. So where do these IP addresses point to?
So question is, where do the IP point to? Like, in physical memory, I can point to the place. How do I know where the IP address point is? We'll talk about that later when we talk about, given that I know where the address of the message is supposed to go to, how does it actually get there? So we'll give a sort of very high-level view of that. And that will hopefully clarify that. Other questions? Okay, so this is just some preliminary. Let's start at the bottom layer. Let's start at the link layer. And as kind of an example, let's look at what actually gets sent at the link layer. So I'm going to talk about Ethernet. I'm just going to give an example. I ran the appropriate utility to capture the contents of what was being sent at the link layer. So one message for the link layer. And here is that message, and I've annotated the parts of it. So we have, on the message, we have to specify who it's to and who it's from, because if it's not there, we won't know. So we specified the destination address. This is a MAC address, because the link layer uses that type of address, and a source address. And there's a type information, and then there's this bunch of data. So this is what the link layer sees, and the link layer's job is just, these are on the same network, we have two machines on the same network, they're just talking to each other, so they send this on the wire saying, hey, I'm the machine with this address, machine with that, you know, this destination address, do something with this message, please. And the type of this message is identified by this number, which identifies that it's IP, that's the type of message it is, it's for the internet protocol, I believe. Okay. And this is how I'm gonna send stuff that's like actually for one of those higher layers. So how does the higher layer get sent? Well, the data of this frame is the message for the higher layer. So start with phrenology here. So say frames data. What is a frame? So we have some different names for the messages at each of these levels. So we're going to call messages in the link layer frames. We're going to call messages in the network layer packets. And we're going to call messages in the transport layer segments. So this is a Ethernet frame. So a message in Ethernet, it's the link layer, so it's a frame. And inside this frame, we have this data, and that data is actually a IP packet. So for the networking layer, it's a message, and it has a bunch of stuff at the beginning of it, specifying, just like the frame did, who it's from, who it's for, and so on. So kind of sort of duplicate. So we have a source IP address, so the address for the networking layer. We have the destination address. We have the data that's going to be for the transport layer. And we also have a length, and we have an indication of what the transport layer is. So in this case, this is specifying TCP. There's just a number that's assigned to TCP. So we have these, in each of these layers, we have what we call headers, which kind of specify who the message is for and other metadata about the message. And then we have the message data. Yes? Searching through the frame contains the packet for the next layer? Yes. And in this case, it's an IP packet. If we had a different networking layer, it would be a different type of thing. Yeah?
Why keep all the padding between each of the bits of information, like the version, the length?
So the question is, what's going on with the parts of the message I didn't mark here? This is not padding. This is stuff I just haven't labeled what it is. But it is extra metadata about the message. Question, are IP addresses and MAC addresses unique to just the local network? So we'll talk more about IP addresses later, where the answer is complicated. For MAC addresses are intended to be unique to a particular piece of hardware. So for example, if my machine has two Ethernet ports and a Wi-Fi card, it should have three MAC addresses, one for each of the Ethernet ports and one for the Wi-Fi card. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so every piece of hardware used would have a unique MAC address.
Question, every piece of hardware used would have a unique MAC address? Yes, that is the intended design. Whether that always happens in practice, maybe not, but that's the intention. Yeah? What does MAC stand for? I do not remember. Something access control, media access control. That's what it stands for. Yes?
Go back to the last slide really quick.
This one?
Yeah, sorry.
Sure. Sorry? So the question, I said this thing was a frame and then it contained a packet. So this whole slot, everything on the slide is a frame.
Yes.
And the part I've marked here as IP packet is the packet contained within the frame.
Right. And you said something about the network layer in here?
So the packet is the network layer's message. So the frame is the link layer's message, which contains a message for the network layer, which is the packet. And in turn, this packet contains a message for the TCP layer, for the sort of transport layer, in this case TCP, which is a segment. So, other questions? So, we have the IP packet. So it has this data. That data is actually the TCP segment. So it contains these port numbers, which that's the equivalent of addresses for the transport layer. It also has the sequence numbers we learned about. There's some other information I haven't labeled here. And then it has the actual data that the program is going to get. Questions about sort of our set of layers here. Yeah?
How does the destination MAC address differ from the source IP before address differ from the source port?
So the question is, what's the difference between our MAC addresses and IP addresses? And what's the difference between the source and destination?
Yeah.
So the destination MAC address and the destination IP address both name, I guess, maybe I should be more careful with that. The source MAC address and source IP address kind of both name kind of the same thing. But if we think about the context here, for the MAC addresses, those are telling us who we're sending to or receiving from on the current network. Versus the IP addresses tell us, you know, at the network layer. So that considers that we might need to go reach the machine from far away. So if I, for example, have a Wi-Fi access point communicating with my machine, all these messages here should have sort of the destination MAC address will always be my MAC address, and the source MAC address will always be the Wi-Fi router that I'm connected to. But if those messages really come from, you know, say some other machine across the network, the destination IP address should match my machine, but the source IP address will be for that machine far, far away. Does that answer your question?
Yes. How about the source port and destination?
How about the source port and destination? So we'll talk more about what port numbers are later, and that should clarify that. But I guess something that will kind of get you the right intuition is that the addresses we have at each layer are for what that layer needs to do. So if we think of the link layer, the addresses are just for doing things on the local network. We think of the network layer, the addresses are for going between machines that are far away. And if we think of the transport layer, they're for something to do with things once we've gotten to the right machine, we need some extra information. Other questions? Okay, so this again gives us a big overview. I'm gonna start with the link layer, talk a little about what happens there. So there's a bunch of different link layers, as I mentioned. So Ethernet and Wi-Fi, probably the most well known. There's some others you probably know about. So Bluetooth, another example. That's a very different link layer than Ethernet or Wi-Fi, even though it also goes over the same radio waves as Wi-Fi. DOCSIS, which is what cable modems use, that's a different link layer. But they all implement this functionality that machines that are connected to the same network need to send and receive messages to each other. That's what the link layer implements. And what is the same network? Unfortunately, that's a little fuzzy. So in Wi-Fi, it's kind of obvious. If you can receive the radio wave sent by the other thing, you're in the same network. But in wired networks, it's a little trickier. Like, do I have to be connected to you on the same cable, or do I have to be connected to the same networking device commonly called a switch? Typically, we say things connected to a single switch are on the same network, and therefore we'll all participate in this link layer protocol together. But there are like exceptions in the real world that you may encounter in both directions. And at the link layer, we specify our source and destination with MAC address, and that just gets us to the machine connected to our same network. If we want to get to a machine not connected to our same network, we need to send it to someone else, and hopefully they process the message in a way which causes them to actually send it on where we want it to go. We'll talk about how might they do that a bit later. Also, typically the link layer will support a destination of anyone called broadcast, where you can just say, I want to send a message to everyone on the same network. And it will let you do that. So questions on our link layer. So I mentioned there are a bunch of link layer protocols, and besides like what media they go over, sort of one of the choices they make, you know, make is sort of what sort of quality of service they provide, and like what, you know, with messages. And for, I have sort of table I made just kind of pointing out things that happen. Some of these may be a bit surprising. So one thing that can happen on our physical media is that two people can try to send a message at the same time. So if we're on a physical wire, we could both try to use the wire at the same time, and that's obviously not going to work. If we're on radio, it's more obvious. We can both send a radio message together, and they'll be garbled. And often, this is handled at the link layer if this is a problem. So for Wi-Fi, for example, the link layer will figure out, oh, we were both sending at the same time. I better resend that, because it definitely didn't get there. If the message is not received, what do we do? And Ethernet has made the choice that they just never try to send it again. They just don't detect that. In Wi-Fi, they decided they're going to try to detect if the message isn't received and resend it. That's a choice they made. Why did they make that choice? My guess is because radio is less reliable, so it's worth resending versus not. If the header or data is corrupted, Ethernet will detect it and discard the message, usually. I say usually because it uses a checksum. Checksum, sometimes you might get lucky and your checksum will still match even though the message was corrupted. And Wi-Fi will detect it and usually resend. If the message is too long, what happens? And both of these link layer protocols, they've decided we have a length we support. If it's bigger than that, sorry, you're out of luck. Just not gonna happen. And if it's reordered, you'll get it out of order. They're not going to try to fix that for you. And if you try to send it somewhere when there's no machine with that destination, it will just go, nothing will happen, sorry, you just won't know. And if you try to send too much, probably some of that will be lost. And these are choices that Ethernet and Wi-Fi make. Other link layer protocols could do other things. So there are link layer protocols, for example, which say, we're not going to reorder anything. That's a valid choice you could make, but it requires sort of different hardware support. Yes? Question, how could data get corrupted? So on radio, if we just have radio interference, we're going to interpret what's coming over the radio as some set of bits, and that could be wrong. On wires, we can have the same kinds of interference, especially like our cable is not of the right quality and so on, and get things that are corrupted. That's for the how they could recover by the link layer. So there's also other ways things can get corrupted, which is actually your next question. But yeah. Other questions? Or follow-ups? Yeah.
So how's it usable if there's so many things that just like doesn't send or discards? Like is it so rare that it's not worth handling?
So the question is, given that Ethernet discards a bunch of things, how is it still usable? So I guess there's two things about that. So one is, we talked about making protocols that handle messages being lost. So it's fine, right? We already handle it. The other thing is that, yes, it's very rare. Especially because Ethernet's typically run over physical wires, which are a lot more reliable than radio. And typically run over physical wires with a relatively short distance, unlike, say, cable modems. You don't, quite low rate of errors, like 1 in a trillion type rates, hopefully. Other questions? Yeah.
So when you said that handled message is being lost, that's going to be handled by one of the next layers, right?
Question, when I say handled message being lost, that's going to be handled by one of the next layers? Yeah. They're going to need to handle that because we sometimes lose messages. Like if our link layer never lost messages, maybe they wouldn't need to handle that. Other questions? Okay, so something you might notice here is that both Ethernet and Wi-Fi, try to detect when the data is corrupted. And I told you about checksums, and if you were looking, I guess I didn't show it, but within here, within here, there is a checksum. I forget exactly where it is. The TCP also has a checksum. And Ethernet does some checksumming too, somewhere too. So if Ethernet and Wi-Fi have checksums, why would we need to do, why doesn't this give us uncorrupted messages? So why can we not get away without why can we not get away without having checksums at the higher layers? What goes wrong? Someone tell me something that could go wrong. So the header of a higher layer gets corrupted? Well, the header of a higher layer is the data for the lower layer. So if the lower layer is checking the checksum, then that should happen rarely, right? That should only happen if we somehow corrupt it and corrupt the checksum at the same time, which maybe could happen. So maybe that's a reason. So it's kind of a more fundamental issue. Is that follow-ups? But we're protecting against the header of the higher layers being corrupted, partially at least. Yeah.
I think you lose information as you go down the layers. You don't know how to resend it if you're too down.
Okay. So what your concern is that maybe we don't know how to resend it if we're further down. So I agree. I agree that at the link layer, we don't know how to resend it for the network layer, but we can resend the thing the network layer sent again. So we can resend in that sense, but maybe you're right, maybe that's not the best way of resending it. But, yeah.
Or to check something for so much data, there's a chance that multiple things are wrong, so it's the checksum
stuff that is right. Okay, so one concern we have is that sort of how reliable these checksums are depends on how much data there is that we're checksumming. And maybe we're concerned that the checksumming the lower layers are doing isn't good enough for our case, where we have a lot more data that we care about. Whereas the lower layers, the main thing they have their checksum for is to make sure their headers are OK. So that's one concern. Yes?
Data could get corrupted between layers.
Question, data could get corrupted between layers. So I like this. Yeah, so what would be between layers? Can you elaborate? Okay, your concern is that it could extend from a layer up the chain, it could get corrupted. So this kind of thing is concerned. So if we think of where that's happening, that would be happening on a machine in the middle of the network. So let's say the way I get messages from A to B is through another machine, C here. So one concern you might have is when C decodes its stuff from the link layer to forward it on to B, maybe while C is processing the message, it corrupts it. Maybe it's broken in that way. We have no checksum for what's happening while the message is on C going between two link layer hops. So we want to have a checksum over the whole process rather than just each of the hops for that reason. Yeah, so that I think is the primary issues, that if you think of what the link layers, any checksumming the link layer is doing is what it's helping against, is helping if the message gets corrupted when it's between the machines. But when we have these extra hops, it doesn't actually protect that. And that is one place where we're doing a lot of work on the messages where we could have corruption, probably about as likely as on the wires in between. Yes.
So for the checksumming algorithm, I know in the lab it was just soaring in real life because it's more complicated than that, right?
So the question is, what checksumming algorithm should we use? Is it more complicated than what's in the lab in real life? So Yes, but not by much. The primary problem with using XOR as a checksum is that there are lots of ways in which you can have something be corrupted in a way which is common on physical wires that will cause the checksum to still match. In particular, if we have two, you know, if we flip all the bits in 16 bytes, so yeah, if you flip two bytes, consecutive bytes together, you won't notice, right? And that's the kind of error, that's the sort of error that might end up happening on many networks, or would be things that wouldn't be detected by the network. So checksums are typically designed to hopefully, usually detect the ways messages typically get corrupted. And that's why something that you might take into account when you're designing checksums, like for Ethernet, is you'll think of how do messages get corrupted over wires, and you'll choose a checksum that usually will trip up the way they get corrupted over wires. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So second question here. So if we have to do the checksumming at the higher layer anyways, right, we need to do it there because if we don't do it there, then you know, we're going to have these places where messages will still get corrupted while they're being processed. What's the benefit of doing it at the lower layers? Why do we want Wi-Fi in particular, especially Wi-Fi? Like Wi-Fi, this is probably more important. Why do we want Wi-Fi to do checksumming? Yeah. Okay, you're saying maybe there's more need for checksumming for Wi-Fi because it gets corrupted easier. Yes, that's one good reason. Some others? Yeah.
So that if something gets corrupted, we can catch it earlier in the process without sending it all the way to realize that it has been corrupted.
Okay, so something mentioning that if we detect the corruption at the link layer, we can do something about the corruption, like we send the message or tell someone the message wasn't received much earlier. Do you want to?
I was just going to say to make sure that we're still sending it to the right place.
Okay, so make sure we're still sending it in the right place. So something to, yeah, so, yeah, we want to have checksumming because we want to make sure, especially, that we leave this stuff for our link layer, you know, that isn't being messed up. Any other, yes. Okay, so let's start talking about our network layer. So network layer is how we reach the correct machine between networks. So we have a bunch of networks that are not connected directly to each other. And you have the internet protocol. You might say, where does internet come from? Internetwork. So it's for connecting multiple networks together. And IPv4 and IPv6 basically provide the same kind of services. There's some details that we won't come up in this class where they differ. But basically, for this class's purposes, they do the same thing, but with different size addresses. And they handle, you know, the same list of things. So IPv4, it's that best effort delivery. So if something's not received, it's not going to handle it. Some higher layer needs to deal with that. If the header is corrupted, it will usually figure that out. So there's a checksum for the header. If the data is corrupted, that's a problem for the higher layer. It's not going to bother. If it's too long, IPv4 and IPv6 have two things they might do about this. So they support messages which are longer than the link layer supports by dividing them up into pieces. Or alternately, they'll send a message back to you saying, couldn't do that, sorry. And if messages are received out of order, you get them out of order. And if you send a message to some place that can't accept a message, usually you'll get a notification of that, not always. And if you send too much, you'll just loose messages. Okay. Questions? Okay, and let's talk about addresses. So in IPv4, addresses are 32-bit numbers. They're usually not written as one number, they're usually written as a set of four numbers, each of which represents one byte of the 32-bit number. And IP addresses are usually assigned to organizations in big blocks. So for example, UVA has all the IP addresses from 128.143.0.0 to 128.143.255.255, that whole range. And Google has lots of, a bunch of ranges. And IPv6 addresses, as I said, IPv6 for this class, basically IPv4 with bigger addresses. So IPv6 addresses are 128-bit numbers. And rather than writing them as a bunch of decimal numbers separated by dots, they're typically written in hex with the part separated by colons. And because we have a 128-bit number and that's very long, often we have these big strings of zero in there, and we'll represent those big strings of zeros with double colons. Yes?
Is there any reason why a lot of local networks reserve 192.168? Is that a special number at all?
So the question is, I've seen 192.168 a lot. Is that a special number? Yes, I was going to get into that later, but I have that slide. I thought I had that slide. Yes. So there are some IPv4 addresses that are special. So one is everything starting with 127 is your machine. It doesn't go on the network. Another is that there are these ranges, like 192.168 is one of them, which are reserved for non-internet use. And we'll talk very briefly later about how that works. And there's also a range, 169.254, that's reserved for use only on the current local network, meaning things that are in the same link layer network. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Now I need to find out where I was. Okay, yes, IPv6 addresses and so on. So let's say we have these addresses. Note that they're assigned in these nice big blocks, and that's going to be convenient because when we want to figure out where a message should go, we could have this table where we specify big blocks of addresses and where they go. So the people who run really big ISPs are going to have machines that are connected to multiple networks. You're going to send your packet their way, and they're going to figure out where it goes by having a table saying, for each of the ranges, where does it go? Which of my three, in this case, three connections do I send it out? And this is sort of the basic way that your message gets to the right place on the internet. You send it one to a router, which sends it to another router, and they all have these tables filled out. Take a networking class if you want to learn how they do that. They have these tables filled out which tell it where to forward it. And because we assign our IP addresses in big blocks, these tables aren't too big. You might say, sounds like they're big. Yeah, they're big, but the numbers I've heard are like maybe 100,000 entries for people way up top on the internet. Just manageable. Questions about this sort of very basic idea of routing in this table that tells us where things should go. Yeah?
It seems like this is very similar to how a page table works. So like that first part is like the typical page number, and then the rest of them are just offset.
So the question is, this seems similar to, like with page tables, how we kind of divided up our addresses into the thing we look up and the rest. It's kind of similar to that, in that, yes, we are dividing up our IP addresses kind of into pieces. Kind of annoyingly for, continuing that analogy, you'll notice that often these ranges are very different sizes. And that's very typical. Other questions? Okay, so I guess in our last, I guess I'll mention, we'll just go on to here. Okay, so we've talked about sort of the network layer a bit, so how it gets messages to the right place, but that's not everything we need to do. We have the transport layer, and it also has some work to do to get the message to the right place, right? One of the tasks besides reliability and streams here I have is reach the correct program. How do we know what program to get to? And the way we do that is with port numbers. So we assign a number to each program on a machine, because our IP address tells us how to get to the right machine, doesn't tell us how to get to, my SSH program versus my web browser. So to figure that out, we're going to add this extra address piece called a port number. And TCP and UDP, the most common transport protocols on the internet, use a 16-bit port number. And if we think of our mailbox model, these are kind of like PO boxes at an address, right? Box number X. So it tells us once we get to the address, how do we forward it further? So this is something the operating system's going to use to help get the message to the right place. And the port numbers, you see, the 16 bits, they're kind of divided into two categories. So we have port numbers that are kind of assigned by hand, and those use the lower possible port numbers. And some of these are conventionally assigned to specific types of services. So web servers are traditionally use port number 80 or 443. SSH servers conventionally use port 22. We've just statically decided that's what we'll use as the default. Then we have a bunch of port numbers that are allocated on demand. And the most common use for this is that if I'm connecting to a server, like let's say I'm running my SSH client, my SSH client's going to look for port 22 on the remote server. But we're not going to send back to my machine's SSH server. We're going to send back to my machine's client program. And my machine will allocate a new port number for my client program. And that's typically done from this range of the higher port numbers. And basically, we'll give each program one or more of those higher port numbers so we can identify when a message comes in from one of the servers it's talking to who it should go to. So questions about port numbers? And I mentioned we have these two common transport protocols. We have UDP and TCP. And UDP basically is giving you port numbers and nothing else. So I talked about how TCP does like reliability and streams. UDP says, well, you don't really need that. So UDP just gives you port numbers. Everything else is your responsibility. TCP gives you that actual kind of connection feel with streams and reliability. And UDP, like basically creating the sockets, looks like what you may or may not remember from using sockets, except we specify we want what's called a datagram socket instead of a stream socket. And then you can send messages, if you like, to a particular destination. And you can receive messages from potentially multiple different people talking to you and figure out who that is. So that's where we'll leave off for today. Next time we'll talk more about how we map from packets coming into programs.